The grade cricketer is a Twitter stream. It's about playing cricket at the grade level.
It's a tough, mean, dirty, dirty business being a grade cricketer.
A lot of cricketers, you know, that's all they know. They've done it since they're 10 and they have a deep-seated fear of change.
But the grade cricket is all about being the most alpha version of yourself as possible at all costs and at all times.
I don't bat or bowl. I just feel the gully, count the number of dot balls in a row, sledge 15-year-olds, make me feel better about myself.
Thanks, champ.
Oh, no, you called me champ.
Hello and welcome to the Grey Cricketer Podcast on the Diamantina Podcast Network. DeMarcus Boogie Harris said, there's a great circuit in Perth. And let me tell you, no one has ever been more sad to leave Perth before a Monday night than the Grey Cricketers. We're going to dissect everything that's happening in the second test there. We are recording this before day five even starts. So we can figure out what happens. Then, of course, New Zealand are playing Sri Lanka in a test series over across the Dutch, and the BBL starts tomorrow. My name is Ian Higgins, and I'm joined solely by Sam Perry this week. Hello, Pez.
G'day, Higgos. A shout out to our colleague who can't be here on this show. Dave is over in Berlin doing very important business, scoping out grade cricketer opportunities over there in Deutschland. I'm going to start a little bit differently here, Higgos. As you mentioned, we're going into day five. We don't know exactly what's going to happen in the test match. We're being very cautious about that. Australia will win. I'm going to read something. Normally we read out viewer or audience messages at the end of the show, but I want to start with something I thought was a little bit special. I want to frame things up a little bit. I thought this was good. It goes for a couple of minutes, so just bear with me. Mm-hmm. I'll get it out. Okay. This is from Branners. Thanks for writing this in, Branners. He just wrote, fellas, this is in relation to some alpha chat we had last week.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. A lot of Coley pain stuff. Right. A lot of stuff is in the media about that today. There's a lot of fascination about it. This is what Branners writes. The day of the relentless alpha, like he of the unmoving face and refusal to engage unless an NDA is in place, is over. Just like everyone now accepts that clowns are the saddest people, anyone with a semblance of emotional intelligence recognises that the relentless alpha is no alpha at all. Instead, we are now in the era not of beta, but of the unassuming alpha. I'm talking about the man with great salad, toned levers, and eyes you can lose yourself in. If he also bowls rockets and can direct hit one stump at the end of a very long day in the field, then all the better. He loves a beer with the lads, and your missus would definitely break up with you to be with him, but that's okay, because you know he'd never cut a mate's grass except with a lawnmower, and he'd definitely be the mate you'd turn to when you need a hand with some landscaping. And he asks a question, and maybe we'll answer this at the end, but to his question, would Nathan Lyon's understanding of horticulture and the growth of grass in tough conditions be enough to get him amongst the first picked in your landscaping 11? He feels that the unassuming alpha and he, so that's Branners, could just watch a few YouTube videos about the differing treatment demands of the grevillea and the brown-scented boronia to learn enough without the conversation invariably heading in the direction of the top 25 bowlers by wickets taken of all time. He says, all the best, see you in Melbourne. So here goes. Branners is onto something here. You know, are you ready to declare the era of the unassuming alpha, especially in the wake of Tim Payne's most graceful comments to Coley last night, where he invariably kind of, well, he gave him a bit of a like an intelligent touch-up, didn't he? We're not used to seeing this. We're not used to seeing Australia as the nice guys and winning. In fact, in living memory, I can't remember Australia as nice guys who win. I mean, we'd have to go back as far as what? Richie Benno, to think of an Australian side who actually were the graceful ones, were the intelligent ones, and won. The unassuming alpha.
Well, Pez, we had Will Somerville on the show last week, and he was saying that, you know, for a number of years, New Zealand were trying to be Australia, and then you made the point that it's really come 360, and now Australia's trying to become New Zealand, and it's better. That people are smiling on the cricket field and it's fun. I'm all about this new funny Australian team. Like no one got abused yesterday. You know, it was just some witticisms. It was clever. It was funny. It was something you can get behind. It wasn't, you know, get ready for a broken fucking arm or whatever. You know, it was just, there was some circuit chat. I'm mainly pleased because this is good for our social capital.
The entire cultural prism is, really.
I was scared when I heard that Australia becoming good blokes because I was like, well, what does this mean for this show? You know, I instantly thought about myself. What does this mean for me? So the unassuming alpha, I just think it's like in the real world, the unassuming alpha is the alpha. But like in Australian cricketing terms, like the alpha is the loudest, dumbest, most enormous person in the room.
That's the
jungle alpha. That's the Australian cricket alpha. But in like real life alpha in everywhere else in the world is the unassuming alpha. So maybe Australia are finally catching up. You know, we've got the NBN coming. You know?
Do we? I mean, we talked about the mixture of technologies last week. It's NBN in name only. You know, let's not go there.
You know, we've got fast trains coming. You know, Sydney's popping in a light rail.
Yep.
You know, there's lots of things. You know, Australia's coming to the 21st century, probably, sort of.
So is Tim Paine is bringing us into modernity. You know, I'm still flabbergasted. I mean, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves because when the Coley stuff started bubbling up, when he started saying, I'm the best in the world, you're the standing captain, when he was trying to get under Paine's skin and stuff like that, and Paine was giving it back, he had to respond to him, and he did, and he did it gracefully.
Yes.
I thought, language is always the forerunner to violence, you know what I mean? It's always in the language that you start using. Mm. Will Australia be able to manage themselves? Will Australia go out with the ball? Will Stark start lipping? Will, you know, they be able to take it? And they've actually responded really well. I don't want to herald the new unassuming alpha era because I think there's a few. We're just again presuming Australia's going to win this match, which will sound incredibly silly
somehow
when
innings.
Vihari plays the greatest innings in Indian history. But and Pant, it should be said.
Yeah.
But when Paine started talking like that, I thought, is this the way forward? Is this what success, graceful success, looks like? And if so, will we be able to handle it? Will it go forward, or will we just wait till we get on a flat one somewhere else and revert to
type? Well, let's see what happens in Melbourne, because I fancy – I mean, who knows? We were talking before the show about what this new MCG wicket looks like. But I think typically – you know, MCG has been low, slow wicket, and that probably suits India a little bit more because of the Australian wickets. It's probably the most like Indian wickets in terms of it's a little bit dead.
Yes. You know,
and this Perth pitch. I keep on saying the Wacker, and we'll get onto that in a moment. But
yes, we will.
But like, yeah, because I grew up in the time when, you know, that's where they played cricket there.
Yep.
I think once the going gets tough, we'll see how it goes again. But I mean, I love it at the moment. I mean, I also thought that what Coley said isn't incorrect. In fact, it's actually very correct. Mm. You know, Tim Paine is a standing captain and Coley is the best player in the world. Mm. But the fact that he said that, I mean, it's one of those things you can't really say. It actually reminded me, you know, that footage of, it's when Tino Best is sledging, Andrew Flintoff. And then, you know, Flintoff says, you know, just be very careful. I've seen this game bite you on the ass. We'll see you are in 3 years' time or whatever. And then obviously Tino Best never played cricket again. So it just reminded me that like Tim Paine's just been around the traps and he is the senior pro. I kind of liken everything about Tim Paine to a guy who used to play first grade and now he's playing threes. Now he's captaining threes.
Yeah.
You know, he's tough to get out. You know, you could see that he once was a very good player and Tim Paine once was a very good batsman.
It's kind of harsh. He's probably the best gloveman in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yes, he's up there.
Yeah.
But he's just, you know, it's just like he comes to the crease now, how do we get this bloke out? You know, if you're playing third grade and you're playing against a guy, the captain, he, you know, he's in his 30s, he's been around the traps, he just knows his game inside out. You know, he might not be as once athletic as what he once was, but that reminds me of what Tim Paine is, and I say that as he is the person who is currently captain of the Australian cricket team.
Mate, I think it's a very apt analogy, and I think Australia's third grade side has needed an old head to come in, and like if ever there was an example of like the ruination of the Shield system, of it becoming an under-23s example, I think Tim Paine has kind of shown that up. He's shown what happens when you bring an experienced head into the side. Like, we watched old-fashioned cricket yesterday. Yes, we're going to concentrate entirely on the verbals because we're a Netflix generation who needs plot and drama, but like if, you know, Khawaja's innings, full of courage, getting smashed everywhere, stayed in. Paine faced 100-plus balls for 37, 38 in the first innings, just took the game away from India. And then to have the kind of like the wit and the poise to respond to Kohli, who was essentially barking at him by saying, the game's got a way of biting you on the ass. Like, you can only say that if you've played like 80,000 years of great cricket and actually been around the traps in life where you understand that sort of arrogance always covers a little bit of weakness. Mm. And, you know, he turned out he was right in that Kohli got out straight away, but he would have been right in any other way too. Kohli could have scored 100, but like Kohli's arrogance will bring him undone somewhere else. I think Kohli's fine. He'll be fine in his life for now, but like, we haven't been able to produce a player like that, like Paine, who could say something like that for a really long time because our system doesn't produce guys like that. You know, it doesn't produce guys who've been around the traps. If you've been around the traps in cricket, you get spat out by like 24 or 25. Paine's hung around. We're lucky to have him. And, you know, I, for one, am enjoying the heralding of this unassuming alpha era.
Just to continue the Tim Paine as a third grade captain of Australian cricket. And that, like, you know, we had him on the show and he was going to a great cricket game.
He was.
You know, he had to drop the kids off beforehand. Hand, you know, we spoke about how he was going to take a job with Kookaburra before he was like, I'll keep playing. Now he's captain of Australia. Just all these like life experiences, just like he's like, it's almost like he doesn't need cricket. You know, he doesn't need
and
this.
And you could see that on his face, couldn't you, when he was talking to Kohler. He was just laughing. He'd been there before. Nothing was sort of, you know, making him flinch too much. Again, these are all the kind of, you know, we sledge baby boomers all, you know, all through this show, and we continue to while we go on negatively gear your third or fourth property and we can't get one at an auction. But experience and wisdom counts for something.
Yeah.
You know, there is merit in having 35-year-olds, 36-year-olds in the side who have been around the traps. Mm. Well done, boomer generation and old people generally.
Obviously, Virat Kohli scored just a magnificent 100 in the first innings. And nothing that we say here takes away from the fact that he most definitely is the best player in the world at the moment. I got to say, not a great captain. He is not.
So you're talking tactically.
I'm thinking tactically. Let's just shift away. I think that, you know, the conversation, the chat's been done. Every cricket page in the world has shared what was being said. So, you know, just tactically, he is clearly involved in the decision of not picking a spinner, a frontline spinner.
Yeah.
You know, Ashwin was just magnificent in Adelaide. Yeah. And our opening batsman couldn't play him, and many of our batsmen couldn't play him. So to not pick a frontline spinner, big decision. Yadav is just an incredible bowler. I was saying to you, Pez, I reckon he would make...
You mean Bumrah.
Sorry, I mean Bumrah. Thank you. Keep saying the wrong name on this podcast. I mean Bumrah, yes. Bumrah is an incredible bowler.
I know
bowler.
You didn't mean Yadav because he's not an incredible bowler. He looks a level below. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bumrah, but we've been like all over how good Bumrah is. So
yes. Yeah. And I think he'd make the Australian team. I think he's that good. I think he's probably better than one of our other three bowlers. You know, he's just, but the fact that he didn't take the new, he didn't open the day, on day three of the bowling, and they did bowl Yadav, first up, weird decision. Mm. So it's like, I'm not sure. I think Kohli's decision making on the field, is not nearly as good as what his batting is. So that's, I find that interesting. Whereas Payne seems to be making a lot of right moves, on the field, but then again, just from experience, probably.
It's funny, you know, we're going to get really lost in the, like, the plot and the drama of, and the morals behind the way the teams have been going at each other, because it's clearly more interesting, to the main sort of stream than the actual tactical cricket stuff going on. But like, there's been so much good cricket in this test match. It's worth calling out how good the cricket has been. It has seesawed. Even the wicket has just fluctuated in character so often. I think in a way that's made it really interesting. At times it seemed really docile. At other times it seemed like it's, you know, misbehaved massively. When the shadows lengthen in the day, Perth, the whole city seems to come alive, both in the wicket and then in the circuit as well, as Marcus Boogie Harris was suggesting. But so much good cricket, mate, like all the way through the first innings through to the fourth, the neglect of Kohli and the Indian side to not pick a spinner has cost them. I think it would have, it would have changed the match markedly. I mean, we were talking off air about the Australian side. Each of them has, and I include Hanscom in this, like each person, like to a person, has contributed in a meaningful way to the match. I won't go through every single one, but think about every player. They've all done something to kind of get Australia over the line. Again, presuming that they're going to win this match. Hanscom included by taking that catch off Kohli, which, yes, was a catch. So, yeah, and, you know, I mean, how much happens in a test match? God, it was only a few days. You know, Nathan Lyon's bowling in Speed Dealers.
It's fantastic. I think there's so many layers to this test match especially. But I think, mate, I think so much of that is based on the wicket. And I know there's been some chat about, you know, the state of the wicket, but, like, no one's getting hurt, you know, like, so Tim Payne in the third innings got an absolute brute of a ball from Shami on his way to six for. It just popped up at him, hit him in the gloves, caught a slip where Kohli proceeded to laugh at him.
Always the worst, humiliation being laughed at too.
Yes, yes, exactly, yeah, and on a cricket field too. Yeah. And then about 2 minutes later, Pat Cummins gets one that rolls along the ground. I think that's exciting. I'm all for that.
Me too.
That's so much more enjoyable than Australia batting first, getting 550, and then bowling out a team for 270. And it's just like that's boring cricket, and that's why, like, people don't want to see that. It's exciting to watch, you know, someone come round the wicket, you know, dusk.
Yeah,
and who knows where what the ball's going to do? I'm not saying, like, you know, every wicket needs to be as exciting as this one. Yeah. Exciting being an interesting turn of phrase there, but like, but I'm all for it, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, me too. You know, the amount of times in this match where Australia have kind of ground themselves ahead through some, you know, what Langer would call tough cricket, whatever that is.
Yeah,
tough pretty boy cricket. Yeah. Only for India to, like, surge back with multiple wickets and leave, you know, Australian fans thinking, oh, God, are they going to go on with it? And then for Australia to grind themselves ahead again, India to come back. Finally, it looks like Australia have kind of got themselves in front of the match enough to go on and win it because India has a massive tail. I mean, it has been really gripping. It has been exactly what we've been calling for, and you have to kind of call that out and acknowledge it. So what I guess we're really saying is let's just ban our best two players every series.
Every summer.
Because now we've got a close enthralling contest.
I think there's something about, like, India are the number one test team in the world. Australia are sixth, you know, but, like, Australia don't like being the plucky underdog in cricket. I think we like it in other aspects, maybe in football, maybe in soccer, I mean. We don't like the Wallabies losing.
No.
You know, AFL teams, we don't mind the underdog. You know, if you're watching a neutral sporting event, always go for the underdog, but not the Australian cricket team. We're not really used to that. But you got to say, we are the sixth best team in the world, mate. We're missing our two best players, and we're giving it a right good go against the best team in the world with the best player in the world.
Can I urge a little bit of caution just to, you know, bring down the fanfare a little bit? Like, I think this Australian side in this match have performed really well. I mean, a lot of guys who we've said before are kind of 6 or 7 out of 10 have given more sort of 7.5, 8 out of 10 performances on a wicket that is like almost customized in a bespoke manner to Australian characteristics and techniques and play.
Sure.
And it has still been close for a couple of days. And that's with India not even selecting their best side. That's the magic of a sort of a 4 to 5 test series that each, you know, where each match goes for 5 days. Like it tends to spit out the best side. So even if Australia do go on and make it 1-1, which means that there'll be at least a live-ish SCG test match. I still would fancy India if Ashwin can get fit to go through Australia. I think the batsmen have improved a little bit. Travis Head looks good. We'll talk about his dismissal shortly. Boogie Harris has done well again. It looks like he's made for the level. But they still look pretty, you know, like, pretty much like they I don't see who's scoring the ton yet.
Yeah. I think it's brittle. I don't think Pete Hanscom plays again. And mate, I can see a real long stint out of the team here. Because, like, for mine, he looks a significantly diminished player than when he first came in the team a couple of years ago. You know, he scored 200 against New South Wales, the SCG, and that was like the breaking point. Okay, this guy needs to play for Australia now. He came into the team, I think it must have been against Pakistan that year, and he did really well, scored some runs, hundreds. And then since then, just seems to, like, his technique seems to have regressed to the point where he literally can't play on the front foot. And he looks so just diminished as a batsman that I don't know what he's got to do now in Shield to warrant getting back in the team, because he's scoring runs in Shield cricket, but maybe against this bowling attack, which is, you know, right up there with the best in the world, he just looks really struggling. So for me, the change is going to be Finch down to 5, and they're probably going to play an opening batsman. We've got Matt Renshaw coming on the show in a moment's time. I forgot to say at the top of the show, people are pretty, they can read. You know, Matt Renshaw is drastically out of form. So I think it's probably Joe Burns who comes into the side, who, by the way, is smashing him in Shield cricket. He's doing as well as anyone else. You know, people are calling for Stoinis. He's averaged 25 in the last two seasons of Shield cricket,
RBS,
and he's injured. And also Mitch Marsh, the 12th man. So he's behind him. For me, the change is Hanscom. I think Hanscom's going to be out of the team for a number of years.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, he got roasted by Warnie, didn't he? On the Rival broadcaster, I must say. Well, it was on social media, but, you know, let's just do it anyway. This is a podcast, Diamantina Podcast Network. This isn't Channel 7, even though we're in Channel 7 at the moment. Warn said, and it was one of those, like, I'm not angry, I'm disappointed tweets, you know, because when Victorians go to town on Victorians, well, that's when you know there's a real problem. And, you know, Warnie came out and said, like, you know, I want to be positive about Hanscom, but enough. This is like a lamb to the slaughter. I've always said you can't do well at test cricket with this technique or something, or words to that effect. I'm tempted to just back Hanscom for oppositional humour. So that when he does succeed, I can say, and I was always behind you. But, like, it was interesting when he got out last time. There's a few murmurs with the people we were sitting with of, like, well, he's gonna continue to get out cutting, because if you can't play a ball on the front foot, then you go searching for the shots that you can play when they're possibly not there, and that has kind of stood to reason in the way that he's got out. And also that mode of dismissal when everyone is calling or is questioning your technique, which he, by the way, to be fair to him, hasn't like tried to change despite howls of protest from every player who's ever played the game that you must be able to play on the front foot, to then get dismissed in the manner that everybody is protesting, that like missing that full one that's cannoning into, you know, the bottom 30 centimetres of middle stump. You know, it's one of those bad looking dismissals as well. Can he get back into the test side, he goes, without playing a straight drive?
I don't know how you can. I honestly don't know how you can. It seems to me that this is one of those things where it just highlights the gulf in first class cricket to test cricket, because I mean, he's done as well as anyone in Australia in the first, you know, five or six games of the Shield season. But just looks miles out of depth in this test side. So I mean, I can't personally see it. I mean, what are your thoughts about my shout for Burns into the test side?
I'd bring Burns in. Yeah. So like, I've been a fan of the. I still think they need six bats because I'm just not sure. Especially if Ashwin comes back in, I'm not sure how many of them have the quality to survive to score 100. There's a lot of survival quality in that side. I do think that they're applying themselves really diligently with the bat. Occasionally letting themselves down in the case of Travis Head throwing away a couple, which is really disappointing. But I think the six bats thing has worked well. I would imagine the only reason they would bring in Mitch Marsh, practically speaking, is if they sense that it's a big batting wicket and the bowlers will get injured without someone to replace them.
It'd be a sports science selection.
It's a sports science selection, exactly. I don't think Mitch Marsh warrants a spot with the bat. Anyway, I'd like to bring in Joe Burns. Like, you know, I've been a white label off the shelf product kind of stalwart for quite a while. I think he's the next best cab. I think his game is in good order. A lot of people you talk to say he is an absolute gun and he deserves another shot, and he'd be a good salad rig-based selection as well, you know, in line with the unassuming alpha. He sort of looks like Pete Murray, but for cricket.
It's not a bad shout. Also Queenslander.
Played rugby, Pete Murray.
Can we talk about the sort of difference between the Wacker and Optus Stadium or Perth Stadium?
Yeah, okay.
I can't decide which one is which.
Yeah, talk about it.
We were very lucky enough to perform at the Wacker on Friday night.
In a room, we should say, not on the centre.
We didn't get a centre wicket in, unfortunately.
Yeah, so it was packed 17,000 house.
But it was, from a personal perspective anyway, like just having a beer before the show started out in the grandstand, looking at the Wacker, it was just like, I've watched many games of cricket here, and there's a lot more character and stuff. Yeah. And then you can literally see over behind this, the scoreboard there at the Wacker is this like just behemoth.
Yeah, a monolith. Stadium.
It's a monolith in the background. And it's like, if you ask people, I think we asked the crowd and they said, no, we prefer Optus Stadium.
Yeah.
And I can sort of see why, because it's like there is shade. I wouldn't fancy being at the Wacker because there's like no shade at the Wacker anywhere.
Yeah, it's hard to explain. So like, we talked to a few locals, and obviously just being, you know, people who love the boutique stadium and all the nostalgia and everything, we're like, oh, I'd just love if it was at the Wacker. There was 19,000 at Optus Stadium, would have packed out the Wacker, et cetera, et cetera. And the locals are fair about it. They're like, yeah, we understand, but if this is the ground that you watch your cricket at every year, you would change your mind about it, because it is like, you know, you go over to the Wild West where everything's bigger. Perth is the alpha city of Australia. Everything's hotter, brighter, et cetera. It only takes about like an hour to realize, oh my God, I'll die sitting here all the time. It was great to sit in the Wacker though beforehand, like before the show. You could feel like that the sunlight was just kind of, it was dappled, you know, over the ground. You could feel the cricketing spirits, you know, you could feel like Brett Lee coming in with the Fremantle Doctor and Mark Waugh shot over the Lily Marsh stand. Thank you. It would have been really nice to have watched a game there, but you do have to listen to the locals who are like, this is fucking shit house if you're here all the time.
Yeah, totally. And I was listening to Christine Matthews, who's head of the Wacker, on Grandstand the other day, and she was basically saying the same thing. You know, there was you know, good numbers for the test match, you know, 19,000, 20,000 people there, which would sell at the Wacker. But it's funny because, like, when you look at, like, the UAE games and, like, you think, well, there's fucking no one there. Like, the Optus Stadium looked almost identical, except, there's 20,000 people there, to be fair, but it's like, it is a little bit, soulless might not be the right term, but it's a football stadium. It's a football stadium.
It is, yeah. It's one of those kind of like a cavernous stadia that's kind of like built for like three contests a year, which probably bring in more tourism money than like small grounds filled. So it's a like a bit of an economy play, which kind of sucks. When you do walk into it, like, it does feel quite like rousing to see it, but like, it's only ever going to pack out for a couple of prelim finals, you know, and some Big Bash stuff. So I do hope like Test cricket somehow gets to the point where it would pack out and you know, generate enough interest where, you know, like 100 there could really be celebrated at, because there's great like acoustics there. All the like facets are there, just not the interest in the sport.
More people listen to this podcast than people attended the days of the test match. Cool. Oh, just quickly, Perth, they want either the New Year's test or the Boxing Day test. Mm. That's what they want.
Yeah.
Stay in your lane, Perth. Is that
stay
what
in
saying?
Your lane. Stay in your lane, Perth. Now that we're back from the West Coast and we're like firmly ensconced on the East Coast, stay in your lane, Perth. Yeah, and come to our shows more than you did. Nah, respect.
Just on that note, just before we go, we head to Jeff Lemons coming on the show and then Matt Renshaw. There are still a few tickets left for the Melbourne and Sydney shows. They are going to sell out. We are going to be in Melbourne on the 27th. That is day two of the Boxing Day Test match because that comes after the 26th of December. We're going to be at the Corner Hotel, which is just the most ridiculous music venue in history. So apparently Jack White of the White Stripes wrote Seven Nation Army backstage. You know that?
Cool. What are we going to write? The 10 people you'll regrettably find at your local cricket club. Each to their own.
Both classics. Both classics. And then we're going to be in the Comedy Store day one of the Sydney Test on January 3 in the evening. I repeat, both those shows are going to sell out. So get tickets now if you want them.
Want to come to the show.
If you want to come to the show, you'll need to buy tickets. Our tour manager, Albert, has got immaculate skin. He was saying...
Beautiful skin. If you meet Albert, yeah, remark upon his skin. Absolutely phenomenal
stuff.
Gorgeous.
That's incredible.
And he does really good dummy ask TGC questions as well when we do a sound test.
He was...
In 94, I took 3 wickets. Am I the beater or my dad? Yeah. He's got the formula down pat.
He was saying to me that like one thing that we go up against is that like men have to buy the tickets. You know, if it was like if women were buying it, they would hear about it and they'd just go, oh, we buy the tickets. Yeah. We get them straight away. Whereas like men be like, oh, should I text someone? Any thoughts? Oh, I might be a bit pissed after the cricket. Yes, you will be, and that's okay. It's exciting. It's a lock-in. It's a lock-in. That's what we're
doing. It's a lock-in. Yep.
All right. That's that show promoted. So Melbourne, 27th Corner Hotel. Sydney, January 3 at the Comedy Store. Tickets, you can get them through the internet. Go to our Facebook page. You know the drill. All right. Any other business? Nah, I mean, New Zealand and Sri Lanka are playing a test match. Tom Latham scored the highest score by a batsman carrying his bat, 264 knots. So well done, Tom.
Ordinarily, that would be the like feature event of any test cricket calendar, let alone week, but... Unfortunately, it's not from Australia, and we live in our own bubble. So, sorry, Tom. Congrats.
And Tim Payne said something funny to Virat Kohli, and DeMarcus Boogie Harris also said something funny. So,
DeMarcus Boogie Harris said circuit. So, let's talk for 10 minutes about that instead of Tom Latham's 264. It's 2018. It's a Netflix generation. It's plot. It's drama. It's character-based. Sorry, that's where cricket's going.
Jeff Levin coming up.
Well, everybody, here goes especially who I'm looking at. It's his first appearance on the show this season, but a long-time friend of the show as well. He's a cricket writer with The Guardian. He's also a broader writer than that. I'd say he does some excellent work outside cricket as well. Definitely a wordsmith. He's a broadcaster also. You can hear him on the ABC. He was on Wisden as well recently. He's all over the shop. Surprisingly tall also, this guy. And finally, the author of a great book out this Christmas called Steve Smith's Men. I'm talking about Jeff Lemon. Jeff, welcome to The Great Cricketer.
Hello, nice to be here.
Nice to have you on as well. You're in Perth at the moment. We're talking as we go into day 5. You know, run us through the you know, the grist of the mill, the zeitgeist. What are the press guys talking about as we head into day 5?
Well, they're talking about not so much cricket stuff because Australia's basically got the test wrapped up unless there's an absolutely sort of freakish escape win, in which case I'm going to look really stupid when this comes out.
It's all good.
But no, it seems like everybody's super excited about Tim Payne getting into a bit of a mouth-off battle with Virat Kohli yesterday. And it was all very nice. It was all very PG. You know, nobody was calling each other any kind of bombs. But, you know, the fact that there was some niggling back and forth, people, they seem like disproportionately revved up by it. They're like, oh, check it out, Tim Payne. Oh, he's such a classical wit. That it's like, okay. I don't think anything that he said was particularly hilarious, but the people just like the fact that there's an Australian captain giving a bit back, and they may be disproportionately excited by that.
Yeah, I wouldn't say, you know, he was Bill Hicks in his wit, but similarly, he wasn't, you know, AB in his pomp either. There was kind of something in the middle. Like, what is it about our fascination with verbals, Jeff? Like, do you think it's a specifically Australian thing? Do you think it's a cricket thing? I agree with you. It's definitely the number one story. I think it's a Netflix generation thing, facetiously. Like, where does it come from?
I don't think it is just an Australian thing, because there's a massive tendency to take normal human characteristics and then ascribe them as national characteristics. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like Australians will say, oh, you know, it's really Australian. We like having a drink and a barbie. And you're like, yeah, no other countries like alcohol and cooking meat. That's just us. You know? Or Australians are like, oh, you know, it's Australian, the Southern Cross, a constellation that you can see from over half the planet, which is also on the flags of about 20 other countries. It's very Australian. So I put it a bit in that sort of camp where, you know, people go, oh, feisty cricket with a bit of verbals. Oh, Australians, we love that. Everyone loves that. Every other country, when that happens, that's what gets the attention. That's what, you know, gets the cameramen on it when there's a bit of back and forth between the teams. But at the same time, we've got this uncomfortable divide where we're sort of, more people now are acknowledging that the Australian team basically have been assholes on the field for a very long period of time, and that maybe it's time to correct that a bit. So we sort of, you know, we want the conflict, but we don't want it to be ugly sort of conflict. So it's a pretty precarious balancing act.
Yeah. Jeff, we were talking about before the series about, you know, whether it was important for Australia to win the series or to win back the hearts and minds of the Australian public. And, like, there's been so much good that's happened on the cricket field, the actual execution of the sport by the Australian players. But, like, all anyone wants to talk about, all of our notifications are, who's a good bloke, who's a bad bloke, did you see this, did you hear this, wasn't this funny? So, like, do what we just want is we just want, like, just nice blokes to be playing for the you know, playing the code in Australia, or do we actually really need to win this series? Is that binary?
It's not quite. I think it would be very hard for Australia to win people over without winning the series. But I guess if they came close, something like the loss in Adelaide, people liked it because it was feisty, because you had the lower order battling away and they very nearly made the runs, and people liked the spirit. And then they also liked the fact that Australia's come out in Perth and given back hard, you know, given as good as they've got in terms of the fast bowling and a couple of players being willing to take it on as well. So it's maybe not absolutely essential to win the series if it were lost in a sort of in a way that does win people over, you know, in a way where people feel like they've got something out of this team. But saying that, you know, that only goes so far. You know, honourable losses will only be tolerated for so long, and Australians are very used to winning and they don't take losing very well.
I can see an XY, like, axis with honourable defeats and appropriate sledging pit against, like, winning via bullying and outright abuse. And we need to be somewhere in the honourable losses quadrant at the moment. But, Jeff, just to continue on the, like, verbal theme and not discussing any technical aspect of the cricket at all, do you sense, I don't know if you get this in the press box, but, like, have they turned up the stump mics on the broadcast? Like, it seems to be double what I've ever heard before. Do you know much about that? And if so, why? I say that actually sitting in seven studios at the moment, could probably ask myself. But have you got to the bottom of that?
What I understand it to be is that this is a Foxtel sort of mission more than a 7-1. I'm not sure if only one broadcaster has control over it, but I think also the playing regulations changed. Where recently, you know, it used to be an ICC regulation that the stump mics were supposed to be down between deliveries. Basically, you'd turn them up as the bowler was running in, and then turn them down as soon as the ball was played, so that you get the sort of nice sound effects of, you know, the spikes scuffing and the bat on ball and the rest of it, but you wouldn't then get the wicketkeeper going, oh, shit shot, mate, that was shit shot. Oh, I wanted to play a good shot, that was shit. Because that was that interesting. Or whatever the equivalent version of that is in Hindi, because Rishabh Pant has been very verbal behind the stumps as well for India. So I think that regulation was changed, and so you can have the stump marks up the whole time. I mean, they had them up the whole time in South Africa when Australia was touring South Africa earlier this year. You know, we could certainly hear everything coming through the radio headphones. But then for this series, we can hear everything because they're just leaving them up the whole time. So the Australians are aware of that. There's no way Tim Payne didn't know that. You know, yesterday, day four of the test in podcast land, there's no way he didn't know when he was keeping that whatever he said wasn't going to be picked up. You know, he knew that his lines were going to be picked up. So it was sort of a PR campaign as well as, you know, actually trying to have an influence on the game.
I wonder who his writer is. Anyway, you just mentioned the South Africa tour. Jeff,
It's actually Don Watson, weirdly.
Well, it's not Darren Lehman.
Yeah, that's right. You have written a very interesting book called Steve Smith's Men, which is based on your experiences of being there in South Africa when it all went down. It does relate to what we've been talking about. Anyway, if people are going to pick this up for Christmas in order to mend relationships with family members, or if their unsuspecting aunties want to give it to nephews who have a cricket bat in their house, what can they expect from the book?
Well, basically it was this. There's a hell of a good story to tell from that tour. I mean, not necessarily a great story in terms of ethics or morals, but you know, it's a very interesting story. And being over there, there weren't many of us covering the tour, so we sort of came home from that trip thinking, well, you know, there were six or eight Australian reporters covering that trip, and no one really knew what had gone on the ground, sort of in more close up detail. So I wanted to tell the version of the story that I would tell someone, you know, over a beer in a pub, sort of the more interesting side of it, and you know, there was a lot of bizarre things that happened. There were a lot of funny things that happened, and it was also very sad and very emotional at the same time. So it was a real roller coaster of a trip. You're sort of watching people's lives fall apart in front of your eyes. It wasn't really fun at the time, but it was interesting. It was fascinating. So I wanted to tell that part of the story, but I also wanted to give people a much broader understanding of that subject, because, you know, everyone I hear talking about it has this really narrow view where it's simplified. It's like either, oh, David Warner's a dickhead and it's all his fault, or it's, you know, Australian culture is terrible. But they're these kind of broad sweeping statements, and there's actually so much detail to why things went the way they did, and the fact that it wasn't just something that was part of the last 6 months or the last year, it was something that was part of the last 20 years at least. So there's so much detail to delve into about, you know, where things came from, where different motivations and influences came from, and also just to try to lay out a lot of the detail of exactly what led to those events, which people don't really seem to know. So I've just pieced together a lot of little threads that say, well, this leads to this and this leads to that, and, you know, the hip bone's connected to the knee bone or whatever it is. Probably not, actually, if you know, it's not going to work very well.
No, that's a thing.
But there are connections between all these things that people don't necessarily draw unless they look at it forensically. So that's what I've done, and I've just tried to lay it out so that people can get the broadest understanding of what went on.
Jeff, we're sort of talking about, you know, the broadcaster's influence on these things, you know, stump marks being turned up, etc. I mean, you and I have spoken previously in the past about, you know, what the South African broadcaster's role in all this was, because the actual incident itself, if we cast our minds back and how choreographed everything was, you know, there was a camera on Hanscom, there was a camera on Lehman, there was a camera following the ball, and there was one on Bancroft the whole time. So, like, was this some sort of, like, you know, tip-off with the South African broadcasters over there that actually knew what was going on? Because it was so well captured in cinematography.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something I've gone into some detail in the book about how that panned out, but it was coming from the previous test in Port Elizabeth, where the South African team was pretty sure that the Australians were up to something shifty with the ball in Port Elizabeth, and they'd passed on information to broadcasters who had started looking for it. People had started talking about it. There were news reports that that David Warner might be up to something, but there was nothing definite. And so for the next test in Cape Town, suddenly he hands over ball. duties to Cameron Bancroft for the first time ever. And so, you know, the official story is that suddenly on the third day they decided to sandpaper the ball for the first time, having never done it before and never thought of doing it before, which is a bit of a stretch, I think, for credulity. But there, you know, there was the broadcasters already knew that something was up, and they had, you know, they had, I think, 8 or 10 cameras on Bancroft. They were following him relentlessly. And then once they got footage of him, they held it back until such time as they were, you know, ready to spring the trap, basically had all the other cameras in place. So then they played it on the big screen at the ground, and then they got the extra footage of him hiding the evidence. So put it all together, it was a very comprehensive sting. But it raises this interesting question that, you know, the broadcaster is a private company. No one's ever been caught ball tampering by their own cameramen. You know, it's always the literally every single time in history that someone's been picked up on camera, it's the visiting team. So, you know, you've got the ICC don't police this. They have the rules against ball tampering, but there's no one monitoring it. There's no one looking out for it aside from the umpires having a look at the ball at the end of each over and saying, you know, what can the umpires say if they find scratches on the ball or something? They don't know how they got there. They can't prove someone did it deliberately. So they've got no recourse, you know. So it's this bizarre sort of no man's land where we all say, oh, this is illegal and it's terrible and it should be banned, but there's no policing of it. It seems like it needs to be one or the other. Either it needs to be enforced or it needs to be legalised.
It's interesting, Jeff, because I think a lot of us would feel a little worn out by sandpaper talk and keen to move forward with the Australian side, where, you know, and that's probably part of why we're glorifying what Tim Payne has done yesterday, myself included. But it's funny, it's interesting from what you've just said then, and there's certainly aspects in your book that kind of raise this as well. There are still things about that incident, which has had such an effect on Australian cricket, a lot of reflection in Australian cricket, that haven't been answered yet, or things that are unknown. Do you think there, and I suppose I include yourself in this, but, like, you know, are there people who are still trying to find out more about what happened in relation to sandpaper, who was in charge, who did it, what actually happened, how long has it been going on for? Do you think there's an appetite in the Australian public to learn more about it as well? Do you think we've heard the end of all the information officially, at least, around what happened with sandpaper?
Oh, I don't think there's much of an appetite for it at the moment because, you know, people are pretty over it. But there would be an appetite if new information were revealed. And I think the big important thing is that none of the players have actually said what happened. None of them have come out and spoken about it. So we still don't have the story of what happened. What we the only thing we have is this charge sheet that Cricket Australia put out in March when they charged the players, which said, you know, David Warner's charged with doing this, you know, developing a plan to tamper with the ball, instructing another player, you know, concealing his involvement, for instance. But we don't know what that means. We don't know how that panned out. What was the time frame? You know, when did Steve Smith find out about it? Did he notice sort of as he was walking back onto the ground on day three, or did he know about it in previous matches? You know, what? We don't know any of that because the players haven't spoken, and they're not likely to speak until their attempts to revive their careers have either succeeded or failed. So I think David Warner is probably sitting on a bunch of dynamite. If he wants to blow up the Australian team, he can, but he's not at the moment because he wants to make a comeback. If he's blocked from making that comeback, he might hit the ignition switch. And certainly once those, you know, once these players have retired in, you know, whatever it is, a year or 5 years' time, whatever it might be, when their international careers are done, we'll certainly hear more about it then because, you know, that's when the tell-alls will come out. But I think it's a massive hole from Cricket Australia that they haven't given a full version of events. They haven't given an account of themselves. And they've been presented with, you know, very, very sort of strong evidence that suggests that ball tampering may have been happening before Cape Town. And they've done literally nothing. They've completely ignored it because they just don't want to know. It's easier not to know.
Yeah. So much detail, Jeff. You can get all of that and all the background into what happened for those who are over there in your book, Steve Smith's Men. I also look forward to the telly movie on this at the end of the players' careers where Lockie Hume plays David Peaver. Jeff, thanks for joining us on the show. That was a great chat, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Weirdly enough, Gary Sweet is still playing Don Bradman.
I am available to play Faf du Plessis if required.
Yeah.
Jeez, Jeff.
It's funny that you should say that because I'm literally wearing a towel as we're
He goes, we've already done an interview with this bloke that never made it to air because our former employers, let's blame them because we are cricketers who just blame other people for anything that goes wrong, lost the recording. But we've got him back again because he's been gracious enough to speak with us. I reckon there's a few reasons why. There's a few things he's done in grade cricket recently that are worthy of conversation. We'll get into that. But let me just give a very brief intro here. He's already played 20 innings at test level. He's got a ton in 350s, a highest of 184. He's just on 50 first-class matches, 10 tons, 11 50s. He also describes himself on Instagram as a hole-in-one club member with a terrible short game. This guy is only 22 years old, so it's a fair bit.
Wow.
I'm 22 years old. I'm welcoming to the show, of course, Matthew Renshaw. Matt, welcome to the Grey Cricketer again.
Yeah, thanks for having me again. Hopefully this one doesn't delete.
That's fair.
He sounds like he's been in first slip before. Renners, can I call you Renners? You know, is that are we at that level yet, or...?
Yeah, definitely. You can call me Renners.
Okay, yep. Good. Thank you. Renners. Renners, tell us where you're at with grade cricket at the moment. I've heard a few things about some of your exploits, but I'm not really sure. But I mean, what does grade cricket mean to you generally?
Grade cricket is something I really enjoy going back to and playing with the guys I've played with. I've been at my club. I've been at the moment for about nearly 10 years, so it's been a while. But it's a lot of fun going back and playing with some mates and just having a laugh, really.
I think you're being a bit humble, if you don't mind me saying so, mate. So you just go back, you have a bit of fun, you just clonk it around, as you say on Twitter. But you're literally breaking records. And didn't you start playing when you were about 6 years old as well? I mean, it's been a big part of your life, surely. I'm going to just press you on this a little bit because you sound a bit too humble for me.
Yeah, I think I started playing in sixth grade at about 13, so... I was tiny. I think I was about 5 foot and playing with all these grown adults who were trying to bump me, so both some half volleys, and they're getting really annoyed when I either played and missed or nicked them through the slips before.
What are your memories, Matt, of sixth grade at age 13? Like, do you have some early memories of playing? Like, not just so much from like the playing point of view. I'm sure that they would have bumped you, then bowled your fullies and stuff like that. But like socially speaking, you know, in Queensland, age 13, like what are you noticing there that's different from playing with kids?
I got sledged a lot for being 13, and I remember getting asked what flavour popper my mum and dad packed me for lunch that day, and I quickly replied, you know, I get Subway on cricket day, and I was pretty happy with that reply as a 13-year-old.
I love the idea, Matt, you're getting sledged for being 13. Like, you literally can't do anything about that. You're, so you're not the same age as me, so I will sledge you about it.
Yeah, I think they probably sledged me about other things, but... As a 13-year-old, I had no idea what they were talking about.
Mate, I'll skip forward a bit before going back to grade cricket because there's nothing chronological about what we do or has any rhythm to it, but, like, do you still sort of feel like that now? I mean, like, you're very well-established now in the Australian cricket scene. People know who you are, what you're about, but you're only 22. Do you still feel like the young guy, or do you feel like a bit of a veteran?
Occasionally feel like a veteran, and I got a lot of close mates in the Timbal team who were around my age. I feel about 16 sometimes, and just get quite immature when I'm playing great cricket. It's quite funny.
Matt, I mean, you are the youngest Queensland player to score a Shield century at 19. You're in the Test squad at 20. I remember last time we spoke, then that you probably never had been out of form before. Your ascension to the top was so rapid that, I mean, there couldn't have been too many low points. I mean, obviously, you know, in the last sort of year or so, you know, the runs have been a little bit leaner than what you might like. I mean, have you sort of had to deal with a little bit of a form slump like this before?
Yeah, probably the last 2 years have been something like that. I think last year I didn't really score any runs, but this year I'm sort of just scoring runs in great cricket and coming back up to Shield cricket and not scoring a run, which is quite annoying.
Mm.
What do you, like, how do you deal with that, you know, given it's kind of one of the first times it's occurred to you over a long period of time? Like, what are you doing at the moment to your game to kind of get it to the level I presume you want it to be at to get back into that national squad?
I'm just trying to keep it as simple as possible and get enjoy my cricket. When I'm batting my best, I'm enjoying it, and I think that's where the freedom of great cricket comes in, and I can just go out and express myself and not have the media or anyone pressuring me to score runs. It's just all about me being out in the middle.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you are obviously CA contracted as well. I mean, do you feel like, I'm sure you're reading the press as well, and there's a lot of people calling for you to come back into the side. Do you feel like you're only a couple of scores away, you know, from making it back into the squad, you know, even for this series against India?
Yeah, I think it's tough at the moment with there being no red ball cricket, but I think there's always an opportunity whether you're playing great cricket. As you guys speak about, it's, you're only four knocks away from a second 11 game if you're in the second grade. So I think I've just got to score some runs at whatever level I play for.
And so, like, with all that in mind, mate, like where do you feel like your game is at the moment? You've sort of, like, humbly said you feel like you've been out of form for 2 years kind of thing, but, like, do you feel like you're close? I know you've made better scores in the past than you have most recently, but, like, you know, where does your game feel like it's at the moment?
No, I'm feeling really good about my cricket. I'm just finding ways to get out, getting some pretty good balls, which is frustrating, but... No, I think it's just when I get that opportunity, like that one at AB where I got 89. If I'd have got a big 100 there, then we probably wouldn't be speaking about my form at the moment, which is just so much cricket that it's sort of that cricket cliche.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, we're doing all these shows at the moment as well, and everyone says we're out of form. mate, you know, it's pretty much the same thing. I'm really curious, mate. Like, I mean, you were over in the UAE with the Aussie side, and you unfortunately got copped that knocked to the head at short leg, got a bit of concussion. I sort of noted at the same time with Langer coming in as coach, there was a bit of conversation about the sort of character it took to make the Australian side and stuff like that. I mean, what do you think about the idea that, like, it's more than just runs and wickets that gets you into that Aussie side? Like, do you sense you need to be a certain type of bloke as well to get in there?
I think so. I think you need to have the values of what the Australian team are trying to have at the moment. I think most people in Australia at the moment are having those values. So I think now it's just about runs and wickets.
Yeah, it's really interesting, mate. Like, do you have a sense, like, that some people get maybe more of a saloon passage than others, you know, in relation to that? Like you know, if you're a good enough bloke, or some of the guys at the top think, oh, you're a nice enough guy that your runs might be worth more than someone else's?
I don't really think so. I think maybe if you have a better rig, then you get picked.
Well done. That's good. That's good. One thing that's got nothing to do with rigs at all, you dealt with that extremely well, is, and you've talked about this before, you know, your dad is a cricket coach, taught sports psychology at Sheffield Hallam University, I believe, over in England, and he played a whole bunch of games with you growing up. I mean, my dad just got home from work and gave me a few balls in the backyard, and God love him for it, but he wasn't giving me the sorts of games you were getting, and I'll speak to him about that a bit later. But can you sort of describe the sorts of things you and your dad were doing growing up, just for any other dads out there wondering how they can get their son to play at age 20 for Australia?
It was loads of just little games, whether that be in the backyard or down at the local cricket club, just having fun and making up some games to do with cricket and not really taking it too seriously, which was a lot of fun.
Mate, obviously the Big Bash starting tomorrow, as a matter of fact. In the past, you've sort of been a bit more of a fringe player. You must be absolutely desperate to be getting out there and you know, putting your name up in lights for the Big Bash.
I think you want to play as much cricket as you can, and I think Big Bash is something that's really exciting for Australia, having such a good competition coming through. And I think playing that one game last year was a lot of fun, and if I can play more games this year, it'll be quite good as well.
Have you spoken to the big guy Chris Lynn about the bat flip just yet for the first coin toss? Yeah. He's going to be the first one to do the honours. Have you spoken to him about it? Is he looking forward to flexing the biceps and flipping the bat?
Yeah, well, I played the club game on the weekend with him, and he flipped his bat. He lost it, so hopefully he can win the one on Wednesday. But
No, I think it's something interesting that just trying to get kids involved in cricket.
Yeah. Has it been much chat about technique for bat flipping? I mean, I know we all sort of did it growing up. You know, normally you'd sort of pick hills, wouldn't you? They're trying to kind of convince us that it's an evenly weighted bat on both sides. Like, what are you thinking? Like, would you sort of naturally lean towards hills, even though it's 50-50?
I think I'm more of a flats kind of bloke.
Oh, interesting.
I feel like the back of the bat is actually good for stopping the bat on the flats. It's a bit like a roulette table. If you sort of have a feeling, you just go with it.
Mm. Well, Faf du Plessis, actually, he gave someone the honour of doing the coin toss, and I like seeing big bash specialist guys, club cricketers, to come in and actually do the bat flip, you know, for the coin toss. That's not a question, that's just a statement off my own ramblings. Matt, obviously the Ashes next year, you spent some time this season playing for Somerset. I presume that was all in aid of getting some experience playing in England, so you surely must have your eyes on England, and obviously the next four Shield games are with the Duke ball, so you must be pumped up to score some runs against the Duke ball to go over to England.
Yeah, hopefully it'll be good to go over there, but cricket, you can never really pencil yourself in for anything. So I'll just try and score some runs, and if I get picked, I get picked. If not, I'm not too fussed about it. I'll try and score more runs in the future.
Mate, I was living in London while you were in Somerset, and can kind of attest to how much people were raving about you over there on the county scene. You played, it was a sort of six-game stretch or something like that, three tons over there. One of them was sort of in a session on a really green deck, showing a kind of different side to your game. Can you sort of tell us about the differences between playing cricket over here and county cricket over there? You know, what did you learn from a technical point of view about playing over there?
The wickets in April are a lot of fun if you score runs. If not, you're sort of questioning yourself and why can't you score runs. But it was something different going out there and sort of just playing with freedom. And I think talking to some of the English guys who have scored so many county runs, they said that the chances to score runs on those green wickets are sort of just to play shots and make sure you're going well with them.
Fantastic, Matt. We'll move into the throwdowns section. I'm sure listeners are wondering why we haven't raised the absolute elephant in the room yet, but that's because all of our questions relate to this particular innings. I'll kick it off. You played for Toombul recently. That's your grade club. You've hit 345 in first grade. It was against Wynnum Manly. 273 balls, 38 boundaries, 12 sixes. It was a grade record, eclipsing Wade Townsend. I guess my question is, when you went back to the club and were asked how you went that day, did you first reply with the team score?
Yeah, you definitely got to go with the team score to start. And then people sort of go, someone must be got runs. And you sort of like, yeah. A couple of boys got 90 and a 70, which was good for the team.
Did you have anyone who deliberately didn't ask how you went as well? Just wanted to talk about the team.
Yeah.
Wade Beckham, the Queensland coach, texted me and said, how'd you go today, mate, at 5:30? And I think he knew. I just said, yeah, the team went really well.
Perfect.
All right, Matt, I just want to know, what was easier for you, scoring 184 versus Pakistan in a dead rubber SCG test, or 345 not out against a pumped-up Wynnum Manly first-grade side?
Probably the Wynnum Manly side. They're bowling really well, and I think any ball had my name on it with the new ball.
Matt, you said in an interview with Wisden recently that during, without Adam Collins, actually, friend of the show, that during long innings, you sing whatever song you have in your head. So, for example, in one Shield 100, you were singing Redbone by Childish Gambino. What were you singing during your 345 for Toombul? The entire score to HMS Pinafore, Fantasia? What was in your head?
I think it was Mbop.
Wow. And you stayed in. That's good. That's fantastic. That's fantastic.
All right, Matt. Were you embracing your inner rare side by having a glass of champagne after said 345 knot? Or was this an alpha power play to show off to your club teammates you can afford a glass of Chateau Neuf de Pape thanks to your contract with CA?
No, I was halfway through a Canadian club when they brought the champagne in, and
and Dad came in, and I wasn't wearing much, which was quite controversial at the time. No, he brought in a glass of champagne, and I sort of thought I had to, which is great. And at Toombul, we have a rule, you can only drink with your left hand, and Dad proceeded to start drinking the champagne with his right hand. And
oh, big fine.
Best day, we quickly made him scull the rest of that champagne.
The inside word on Renshaw's 345. I don't know how this will go down, but Matt, you made your test debut at 20, you were dropped at 21, recalled at 22, dropped at 22. Bet you can't wait till you're 23.
Yeah, it's the end of the season, so I'm not sure what will really happen then. Hoping for some good birthday presents and runs.
Nice one, mate. Thanks for dealing with all of that, Matt, especially at the top with a couple of those questions about character. But you're doing really well. It's great to talk to you. It's great to actually just be reminded of how young you are as well and everything you've achieved in the game. Just before we called you, we sort of said, oh, I'm sure this bloke's going to score between 8,000 to 10,000 test runs. So do remember us, and we'll just make sure we hold up our end of the bargain when we actually record and post this, unlike our one at Fox Sports. But thanks for coming on, mate, and all the best for the rest of the year.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
I think it might just skid on.
I refer to the great cricketer here, and I'll say, this will do a little bit early.
Now, he goes, you don't associate budgie smugglers, swimwear, that archetypal Australian image of the bronze Aussie, etc., with the UK, do you?
Not always.
Not always. However, if you did follow the budgie smuggler account last week, you would have seen that the CEO, Linney, and some of his friends, all of whom have good rigs, it must be said, and that's not a sponsored comment, that's just my own view, were on the Today Show with Carl, etc., in Shoreditch in the UK.
No way.
Modelling the swimwear gear.
Unbelievable, Jeff.
Unbelievable scenes. Mm. They were doing it because, as you can tell, with us being on the here as well, they want to flog gear over Christmas, and rightly so.
They got to flog gear over Christmas.
So they do more than just swimwear. You don't have to just wear cozzies, togs, budgie smugglers. Right. I don't even know. See, now you can tell it's not a sponsored comment because I'm not meant to say cozzies or togs, but I did, and I'm sorry, Linny. Let's continue anyway. Budgie smugglers is what they're called. Yeah. They have non-swimwear, though. He goes, right, they've got Hawaiian shirts, they're all fun, they're colourful, they've got socks, men and women, male, female.
So it's Christmas time, it's Christmas wear, budgie smuggler Christmas wear. What you're saying is get your jingle balls into a pair of budgie smugglers or socks, you know, if it's particularly lonely Christmas, or shirts. I don't know what you like to do in your own time, but get them in there.
Exactly.
Budgie smuggler.
Colours in, a lot of Hawaiian style stuff.
Yeah.
Customise it if you want, retro cricket gear. You've got no excuse from a clothing point
of
view.
They have options. From a clothing point of view, you have excuses. In other parts of your life, you've got other excuses, you know. I didn't hit it, I smashed it, it carried, it didn't carry. Whatever you want to do, whatever you want to lie to yourself.
I don't play on the front foot.
I listen to these guys on this podcast and they tell me what to do. Whatever excuse you need, but with you know, for you know, Christmas wear, budgie smuggler, no excuse. I got no excuse.
It's budgiesmuggler.com.au.
It has been referred to as the best sports writing tribute to a particular sport since Fever Pitch.
Does it do anything to enhance literature? Would be another question.
Another. I wouldn't even call it literature, really.
Hashtag ask TGC. This is going to be, we're just going to take a week off over Christmas because Christmas Day this year falls on a Tuesday, which is the day that we record both the Channel 7 show and the podcast. So obviously we're not going to be doing that on Christmas Day, but we are going to commit to that on New Year's Day because we'll be here in Melbourne filming the show.
And New Year's Eve and New Year's Day is overrated.
Yep. Says the guy who's got a kid. We're just going to take the week off, but we're going to be getting you through. Obviously, there's the Big Bash starts tomorrow, so there's so much. There's going to be cricket nonstop.
Yeah.
Relentless cricket endlessly. So much to talk about. So we're going to take the week off for Christmas. Hope you're having a good Christmas, et cetera, et cetera.
So genuine. We're nice to our fans.
We're nice to the fans and they're nice to us in kind. All right. Pez, the Ask TGC is this week, I'm going to go down a bit of a different route.
Ooh.
Because several questions came in just asking, well, let me read them to you and you'll see. So Liam Freelay says, do you blokes actually like Virat Kohli? James McElligott said, who is the worst bloke, Dave Warner or Virat Kohli? Seth says, when Aussies sledge, it's fighting spirit, go on champ, when it's Virat, Broad, KP, Stain, etc., you lot have a cry and say, show some class, it's a gentleman's sport. Virat plays like an Aussie and you can't handle that. Why is there double standards? So what I'm saying is that people only really seem to be interested in who's a good bloke, who's a bad bloke. There's so much cricket going on, and this test series so far has been back-to-back, like really interesting test matches. But no one is talking about that. All anyone cares about is who's a good bloke.
Heroes, villains.
Yes. Yep,
the hero's journey.
So, first of all, you know, there's got to be some better hashtag AskTJCs out there, of which I'm saving for the TV show.
Not the first time we've taken away from the cast to embellish a TV show. No, that's not true. The TV show goes for like 25 minutes, and this is what? This is an hour plus.
Yes, hour plus. Yeah.
Of key kind of unrefined, meandering content.
It's just a conversation.
Just a conversation.
Just a conversation. Okay. So, I mean, so like, what's the deal? I mean, first of all, I don't know if we need to actually answer every single question.
Yeah.
But I take Seth's point in that, yes, there are certainly double standards because Virat Kohli, if he was Australian, probably Prime Minister, he'd be celebrated in a similar way to what Dave Warner was by certain sectors of, you know, the Australian cricket consuming public.
Barbecue land.
It's barbecue land. So, but why do we only care about who the good blokes are? Is the sport struggling? Is the code struggling so much in test match cricket that we only want to hear chat and we don't really care about Khawaja's gritty 70, you know, to get us into a winning position or, you know, who's good, who's, it's just all.
I can only gather. So the first thought I have is that, like, I think about other sports, and while other sports do talk about their characters and laud their characters a little bit, you think about the NBA or Premier League, they do talk about the personalities of players a little bit, but I wouldn't say anywhere near as much because there's actually things going on in those sports. Mm-hmm. Like there's some more kind of tangible, visceral, viscerally deducible actions that they're doing. Whereas in cricket, you know, like literally there's not a lot of physical movement and activity happening. Right. So from a TV perspective, there's a lot of close-ups, there's a lot of sound, there's a lot of chat. Mm. And so it kind of gravitates towards a more kind of human interest kind of pursuit, I guess.
Are you saying that both teams need to have professional debaters on either side?
Look at Payne yesterday. Look at how much of a PR bump you can get by just stringing a few words together. Mm. Like, how many times have you played cricket, he goes, and like all manner of things can be happening on the field, right? Say you're batting.
Right.
All manner of things could be happening. The wicket could be playing up. The bowlers could be doing things. Your teammates are positioned pretty much square on, so they can't see what's actually happening. The ball could be swinging. It could be spinning. The game could be in a precarious position. You get dismissed. When you walk back in to the dressing room or to the pavilion area, there are so many things they could ask for a briefing on.
Yes.
About the game, and invariably, like Family Feud, the number one thing that's asked is, what are they saying?
Scoreboard says.
Yeah. What's the chat? You know, like we're just fascinated with the things that are said on field. I'm not sure it's ever going to go away. Jeff's kind of said earlier, it's not a particularly Australian thing. That may or may not be true. We do get particularly interested, I think, in Australia about who's a good bloke and who's a shit bloke.
I think it is an Australian thing because we've sort of hung our hat on the reputation.
Yeah, it has
of,
to be.
Yeah. No, it's ours. It's ours. Only ours.
The business model.
Yeah. I think there's so many interesting things about that. I think like CA have, they have also released this. It's almost propaganda that they've got the nice guy Tim Payne as captain there behind the stumps.
Yeah.
Jeff Lemon said before that just like that he, you know, he would be very aware that the stump mics have turned way up and everything that he's said is going to be pushed out there. Mm. You know, DeMarcus Boogie Harris, you know, standing there at bat pad. I've also known that. So
we've not mentioned his 60 or 70 once on
not
the show.
Once.
We've called him DeMarcus Boogie Harris 8 times and talked about.
Yes, we're trying to get that trending.
Yes.
Yes.
it's just data. I'm just giving it data.
It is interesting. I mean, you painted that scenario very eloquently about me, you know, batting and took me back to some very happy and dark times all in one motion there. But like, it is a thing that like when you walk out and you say, well, what are they saying out there? Because it's just like, am I to brace myself for someone to say something mean to me?
Yeah.
And is it just because cricketers get bored? I mean, like Steve Waugh sort of said it's mental disintegration. If you can get 1% out of them by thinking not about cricket, about the skill they're executing and actually, you know, distract them, then, you know, the job is done. Or is it just because, like, you have an opportunity to get away with it because it's cricket?
I think that, like, we're it's the reverse of being like confident. Like we're all afraid of being bullied so much because we know how unpleasant the experience is that we then as Australians flip that and go, or maybe not Australians, maybe more people, but I think in Australia especially, we flip it and we go like, well, if it's so unpleasant to experience, then I'm going to do that to somebody else because then they will therefore play badly. It's just it's a basic formula. It's a basic calculation. And then Tim Payne kind of like lit up this other way yesterday. Australia might win the game and be kind of the funny, graceful guys at the same time. What are we going to do with it? We'll no doubt flip out as soon as we lose something.
Yes.
I've got no doubt that like in, you know, 12, 24 months, we'll see an uprising again of the of the unrelenting alpha.
Of the
alpha. Yeah. like he will be back. No, and hopefully we will be here for that.
It's like part 7 of the Planet of the Apes, the uprising of the unrelenting
alpha. That's what we're saying. I'm not sure where Australian cricket is in the Simpsons episode season, like seasons at the moment, but we're kind of in like season 8 at the moment, and there's been a full flipping of the characters.
Right.
You know, or like Doctor Who having a woman. I've got no idea about Doctor Who if that's even close at all. But like, we're in season 8, you know, of Australian cricket. There's just been a little uptick in what's happening in the plot. So I'm sure, you know, like Carl Kennedy will be back or Paul Robinson or whatever, the unrelenting alpha.
All right, well, we'll sign this one off. Dave will be back from Berlin after we send him off like, over there to on a fact-finding mission, to see if there's any cricketers happening in Berlin. Almost definitely not. Merry Christmas to you and your loved ones from all of us at The Grey Cricketer, recording the episode 3 of the Channel 7 show this afternoon, and then we'll be back in a couple of weeks' time on New Year's Day. So we'll see you then.